Welcome to the show. This is supposed to be the Watson Weekend. I'm Rick Watson.
And I am Nick Kaplan, joining Rick Watson after that amazing intro.
It took you a second there to remember who you were.
Well, you know, I forgot for a second with that intro. So, but it brought me back to reality quickly.
I love it. It is pre-peak season. I think Prime Day happened. Did you miss it?
I tried to get involved, but it didn't really work that well for me.
No, it's that time of the year where you're preparing just how much margin you're going to lose.
Exactly. Exactly. It's the row. It's like I say to people all the time, there are 2 weeks of the year to focus on ROAS, and they're coming. It's like the week before Cyber Monday, the week of Cyber Monday, and it's coming faster than a speeding bullet.
Yeah. And so it's almost that wonderful time of the year. So we're here to break you through, talk about the greatest retail news of the day, and hopefully give you a few laughs at the same time.
Yes. I mean, the forecasts are coming. We are now thinking inventory. You know, Captain likes to talk a lot about inventory. Hopefully everyone's ready, but we are coming towards Black Friday, Cyber Monday, and we are thinking about strategy, and we are thinking about all the things we can do to pepper the word free, the most powerful word in the English language, into our strategy.
That's right. Free shipping is going to be there for everyone. We have a great guest on our show, Tommaso Tambronati, the CEO of EasyShip. Before that, we're going to go through some stories. But even before that, we're going to talk about our great sponsor, Miracle, with our show. They've been with us through a great part of the year. Growth isn't just about speed. It's about direction. Miracle gives you the infrastructure to scale smarter, not just faster, with marketplace, dropship, retail media, and a seller platform powered by AI and built for what's next. So thank you, Miracle, for supporting the show. We're excited to have you. So with that, we're actually going to head to the headline hangover. All right. We're playing Stump the Chump today, let's be honest.
I mean,
and let's guess which one of us is the chump. Walmart partners with who to create AI first shopping experiences. Remember, none of us have seen these quotes, stories.
I mean, I thought I was gonna, you were gonna stump the chump. You're starting easy. I mean, I think anybody, my nine-year-old probably gets this one. OpenAI.
OpenAI. There we go. There's Mr. Altman here. We're actually, you know, Nick is going to get all the points today because I think we're just going to keep it rolling with Kaplan. So Walmart has announced that they're going to be in ChatGPT shopping. The checkout is going to be in there. Their catalog is going to be in there. They weren't that specific about what products are going to be in there. Is it just their first party items? Are their marketplace items going to be in there? Are loyalty, like they mentioned Sam's Club in the release, and so we know that's going to be in there. So there's some kind of identity integration. What do you think about this?
I think the other thing too, it seemed like a bit of a perk, right? They mentioned members. I mean, there's that big Walmart Plus shopping push. Look, my two words are no duh.
Right.
I think so much is happening in the world at the moment. I read something yesterday by Catherine Black from Kearney, who I actually happened to run into at dinner this week, who's so smart. And what she said is, it's really not e-commerce anymore. It's just commerce. And so the fact that this is happening surprises nobody and is going to just continue to set the bar for everybody to break down the barriers and the walls so that we can effectively provide people with whatever it is they need when they need it with less friction. So kudos to Walmart, who does it well and is really setting the bar high, or sorry, lowering the bar rather, I'd even say, for everybody.
Right. Yeah, and I think the question on everyone's mind is if even if someone like Walmart is going to get in on this, Who's not going to get in on this? And the answer so far seems to be only Amazon.
Rufus.
So Rufus, woof. Yeah, he's like left outside.
Do you ever use Rufus?
Sometimes.
When I use Rufus, when I inadvertently think I'm hitting the cart and I actually hit Rufus, because what they've done is they've put it in a place in the bottom right where you think you're going to get the cart.
Yeah. Maybe he'll lead you to the cart.
I don't know.
All righty. So Walmart partnering with OpenAI. Good job. Just
1-0 for Kaplan.
1-0 Kaplan. The next one, Blanks Sora. It's 1 million downloads in less than 5 days.
Blanks. I mean, again, OpenAI's Sora.
Yes. Seems to be a trend here. Mr. Sam Altman. I think he's popping his collar in this photo here.
This was a big week for Sam Altman and that company. There's a lot of too big to fail being thrown around right now, but what do you think?
I think it's going to be a fascinating thing, because if you've seen it, I don't know, I've gotten one of the codes, and I didn't spend that much time on it, to be honest with you. I didn't upload my own thing, but you basically create a prompt, and it will create a video for you, and then you can, it's like you're a creator without having to make a video, which is super interesting, because people are saying, like, I don't know, the one I saw the most was like there was a hurricane at the door and someone trying to get in, and people were making like different characters there.
Right.
It's like, great, but make it Kaplan.
Right.
And like Kaplan was at the door trying to get in. It seems, I do think it can be entertaining. Will it be as entertaining as YouTube or TikTok? I'm not sure.
Well, I think that there's so much possibility, and the one thing I'm certain of is that I don't know. I think that we are just speeding up innovation being driven by AI. I think that there's a lot of deals happening, a lot of opportunities being presented, and as I've been saying about AI since its real, you know, sort of inception on the floor of commerce, is what it's doing is leveling the playing field. And I think that you no longer need to be a deep-pocketed Walmart to be on the cutting edge. You can be a person who has got an idea, is really good at orchestration and execution, and be competitive. And so someone showed me a site yesterday. I think it's called Mellow Sleep. And this site, you should all look at it. It is Growth Hacker 101, born in March of 25. Now the numbers, which I won't say, are really impressive. We're now talking, you know, 7 or 8 months later, all driven by AI, all driven by having the opportunity of Shopify and really knowing what to do best. And so anyone can start a business now, and this is really just going to further that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's fascinating. If you look at sort of the history of advertising, which OpenAI is definitely going to be heading in this direction.
Really?
one of the, I mean, before you create magazines and content and you would have slots for ads, right? And it would take so much to create these ads. And then you have Super Bowl ads. Google created one of the biggest and greatest advertising businesses of all time, because the ad surface is every page on the internet. And so that times the number of search terms that people type is a huge amount of ad inventory. Facebook did them one better, basically saying anything about my day can now be served an ad.
Right.
Like, what's my cat doing? What did I eat?
Bring it into my life.
Yeah. Bring it into my life. How many times a day? Not just when I create a web page or search for something. This could be something that's interesting. If AI is creating these videos, it could be easier to do than even Facebook. And so the thing that's most interesting to me is the amount of ad inventory that this could create. The only question then becomes user attention.
Right. I think that that's definitely something, and you know, I know we need to keep moving, but the whole value, lifetime value, or the loyalty and how brands trade on that over time, right? Because so many of the people we work with break down contribution margin times frequency over a defined period of time to equal value and then begin to go work backwards to acquisition, this could totally change that, right? Which is, it's like less devoted time and experience to just experience. And experience creates like no loyalty. So really interesting.
Yeah. No, that's fascinating. All right. Our next story, Salesforce and blank partner like, across enterprise work and commerce.
It's like Final Jeopardy. Can I bet everything? Let's see. OpenAI.
All right. Yes. This is
feel
good
so
news.
Good about myself.
Good work, Kaplan. This is an interesting thing. I mean, I think Salesforce is going all in on Stripe's ACP. They had previously partnered with Google. Basically, it means I think like every platform they're going to partner with everyone. They seem to have renamed their entire platform Agentforce. Agentforce used to just be their platform for building agents as developers. Now Agentforce, it's almost like when Microsoft renamed everything Office.
Right.
Now Salesforce has renamed everything Agentforce. And so I think the term becomes useless at the end of the day. Salesforce, Agentforce, like maybe one of those forces is redundant.
Oh, I thought when you said the term becomes useless, you were talking about Salesforce.
Oh, there you go.
Look, again, surprising nobody. I think that Salesforce has been on the backs of their heels from Shopify for a long time. They've taken people, they've taken ideas, and they've tried to unsuccessfully take clients. Whereas Shopify has done all of the reverse, right? They've taken a lot. And so in a bid to evolve and serve the clients that remain on the platform, they've done something smart. They've effectively tried to integrate the AI from OpenAI into what they're doing to build some level of glue for clients.
Stickiness.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't think it's going to make a difference, as the other two stories we talked about just shows the proliferation of OpenAI everywhere, but good for them.
Yeah. I mean, who's doing as much as OpenAI right now in this space? Google, like, hello, Apple, where are you?
I mean, I think Google is probably doing a bit of a good job, but Apple, yeah, where are you? So.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. So, looks like the chump wins this one.
The chump wins, and the chump will bring us to the next part of our show, which we're super excited about. We did have Tommaso Tambernotti on the show. He's the co-founder of EasyShip, a leading logistics platform which is designed to help e-commerce brands streamline their shipping operations and reduce global delivery costs. He was a Forbes 30 under 30. I always wanted to be one of those like 40 under 40, 30 under 30 people. But, you know, he launched EasyShip with a mission to make cross-border, which is your favorite thing, right? Shipping more accessible and scalable for growing businesses. And so today, EasyShip powers hundreds of thousands of merchants across North America, Europe, and Australia, which it offers a really big suite of smart shipping tools, powerful API, and seamless integrations with all major commerce platforms, with access to over 550 global shipping solutions and discounts up to 91%. So I'm psyched to see this interview. You guys really also do a good job, and I've seen a couple of previews of this. It's going to be awesome.
Yeah,
so.
This was a fun conversation. We talk about a lot of different topics, including why logistics is hard. Also, there's a topic we threw in there about shipping fraud, shipping label fraud, which is something that a lot of people don't talk about, meaning like carriers getting scammed by shippers or fake shippers in some cases.
That. Yeah.
Right. And it's sort of like a little bit of an underbelly of commerce that you don't hear about a lot.
It's true. Well, I had fun today. Thanks for having me on. Excited for the interview.
Awesome. Thank you.
So happy to have here the founder and CEO of EasyShip on the show. Welcome, Tommaso.
Hi, Eric. Hi, Jess. Great to be here.
Yeah, we're excited to have you. Again, logistics and shipping, supply chain, this is all Rick's love language. So he probably couldn't sleep last night because he was so excited to dig into all these topics.
Yeah, I think we're going to cover a number of different topics, just like why is logistics so difficult? This sort of fraud label problem that I don't think a lot of people are talking about, which seems to be plaguing the industry, but is still kind of under the radar. And then it's kind of, where does logistics go from here? But first, I wanted to just dig into your background. EasyShift, why does EasyShift exist? Where does it come from? And how does where it come from inform what you work on today?
Yeah, sure. And by the way, I'm a big fan of the show. It's one of the best ways for me to keep up to date with what's happening in the e-commerce space and logistics as well. So it's great to be here. Thanks a lot for having me. So where to start? I actually don't come from a logistics background originally. I study business and finance. I started my first job was actually in investment banking, and it played out quite differently than what I in the beginning. So I kind of like work hard 5 years at uni to go into finance here in London. Yeah. And then once I made it there, I realized it wasn't necessarily for me. I'm a big student of finance, love the topic, but working in there, at least for me, wasn't the right thing. So I decided to leave the space, and I wanted to get my hands more dirty and kind of like build something. And so I joined an e-commerce platform in Asia. And so I packed my suitcase and left to Singapore and Malaysia at the time. I joined this company called Lazada, which still is one of the major e-commerce marketplaces in Southeast Asia, with operation in Singapore, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia, Vietnam, Philippines. And I worked there for 2 years. And while we were there, I kind of like had the chance to touch with my own hand the issue of shipping, especially cross-border shipping for e-commerce. In the US and in Europe, logistics is quite advanced, quite established, quite efficient. Yeah. But when you are in other parts of the world, is a bit more emerging. So it still lags a bit behind in terms of infrastructure. And that's what we saw when we were there. So my job was to sign on e-commerce merchant to sell on the platform. And when I was going to these merchants, everyone was eager to start. But then once they realized that they had to ship cross-border intra-APAC, it became very complex.
Yeah.
And they asked us for direction. They were like, okay, you want your clients to not pay any custom duty. You want your clients to pay anything on the door. At the door, which now actually is very relevant also in the US, right?
With
the latest developments. And we couldn't help them because we didn't have necessarily the infrastructure. And so this merchant decided not to sell with us because it was just too complex. Mm-hmm. And so we couldn't just go back and say, okay, sorry, we did our job, but it's not my fault if there are no logistics. So we had to kind of like build that ourselves. And this was one of the best things in working in emerging market when you build e-commerce solutions. Is so much dependent on the underlying infrastructure of logistics, right?
Yeah.
And so we started to become more intrigued and more interested in the logistics space. And we started to kind of like build a very scrappy, very basic, but efficient, effective Excel models to kind of like we're mapping all the different tax and duty for every country. Mm. And so we were telling our merchants, like, input your catalog in this tab, click this button, and we will compute the full landed cost.
Wow.
And again, it wasn't great, but it was working because it was not available. And we were searching online for tools like EasyShift, and it wasn't existing at the time. And so we're like, okay, fine, we'll do it with Excel. But then once we started seeing that it was working and our merchants were asking us for similar things for other markets, while we couldn't do it, we started to realize this is a big problem.
Yeah.
In most billions of dollars, and there is nobody out there that simplified global shipping for e-commerce the same way certain companies have done for finance.
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided to resign and to start EasyShift, of course, abandoning the idea of Excel and investing heavily in a fully API-based solution, fully front-end-based dashboard, mobile app, and kind of like make the solution a lot more sophisticated. And that's how we started 11 years ago.
Wow. Well, that's impressive. Going from an Excel model to API. A lot of times people feel like they've got to build the perfect thing before they can get to any real like market fit or create a product. So it sounds like you guys got really scrappy, which is amazing.
Yeah. And again, it wasn't really our core our core job at the time in Lazada, but we had to do it to kind of like achieve our goal, which was onboard merchants, right? And once we unlocked the logistics side, everything became a lot easier. So logistics was a way to enable these merchants to tap into new markets and increase their revenues.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating because, I mean, just that insight, I think, escapes a lot of marketplaces who don't view it as their problem. Do you think the fact that there are just so many countries involved and the fact that you guys were an upstart meant that you couldn't ignore it like some of the bigger players?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I think like in general, like the companies we were speaking with, they were really selling on the main marketplaces in the West. They were selling on Amazon. They were selling on eBay. And they were telling us, you know, we already do cross-border. We are totally down to it. If I have to sell on more marketplaces, sure, we sign up tomorrow because it's a way for me to sell more. But it has to be, there has to be a right balance between the addressable market you give me access to and the additional complexity you ask me to comply with, right? And in this case, it was too complex compared to the additional revenues you're going to get, right?
Right.
And so we have to make it easy to justify the additional revenues.
Talk to me about the countries that you supported. And were they all the same, or did you have to provide different solutions depending on the type of country, how open or closed they are to merchants and easy for buyers?
Sure. And Rick, you're referring to Lazada? So Lazada operate in 6 markets, like Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, Vietnam, Philippines, and Indonesia. So all the Southeast Asia region. And we were allowing merchants based in any of these 6 markets, but also based in China and Hong Kong, ship to the rest of Southeast Asia. So it was kind of like a N times M combinations. There were like 40-something plus different combination of potential duty and tariffs between different markets. And there were not so many bilateral agreement at that point between these markets. So it made it exponentially complicated.
Yeah, I can't imagine. And it sounds like, you know, once you solved that problem, you had an unlock. What are the other learnings you took from Lazada that helped you as you were building EasyShip in terms of, it sounds like, I know you're very focused on the customer experience, making sure customers are never surprised at the last mile, but were there some other things that you took with you in that experience?
Yeah, definitely. I think in general, like we had to grow really fast, so we were working extremely hard. Like I remember literally working from 9 a.m. to 2 a.m. most days, and then there was a very strong camaraderie among ourselves, and so we were kind of like working and going out partying and have dinners together. So it was kind of like a uni. It was kind of like a uni experience in a way.
Yeah.
Where you work far, but there is no such thing like work-life balance. It's more kind of like combining together and intertwining working and life experiences, which was extremely. It was a great experience and personally allowed me to learn a lot about. What to do, what not to do, and especially we were super young. I was 24, and back then managing 10 people. So for me, compared to banking, it was amazing because banking it was extremely very very technical. It was very demanding. But I would have never had the chance, for example, to manage people at that age. You know, you need to wait several years just to be able to talk to a customer, right? Well, there I had incredible experience since day one, and the kind of experiences in any other established corporate I would have to wait 10 years to have. So it gave me like an incredible exposure to talking to customers, managing people, and be able to achieve like double digit growth month over month, which
that's impressive.
Everyone always likes to hear what not to do. So I would love to hear, you mentioned in your answer, you learn what to do and what not to do. Like what are some of the things you wish you would advise you would give to your 24-year-old self that you would have done differently?
Great question. Where to start? I think we were working super hard, and sometimes it's not necessarily good because you go down the tunnel and you don't really question whether what you're doing is the right thing, right? So you keep building something, and then maybe after 6 months you're like, okay, we're done. It doesn't make sense. Okay, great. Yeah. I wasted 6 months working 17 hours per day. Maybe I could have taken 2 hours per day and think more, and it would allow me to not waste the time like this. But I think you have to go through it, right?
Yeah.
I learned about how to leverage more on data to kind of like not being another person with an opinion in the room.
Mm-hmm.
So right now I'm in a stage of life where I'm extremely focused on numbers. Like everything is, every idea is great to deserve attention.
Right.
But the idea is it deserves to have a chance to be backed by data. That's kind of like the idea is, sure, it sounds interesting to make sure that any of us is right.
Mm-hmm.
What data can check to back us up, basically, right? And then I think in terms of management, the importance of having extremely clear KPIs for everyone. For example, I think that in those years we're working very hard, but when I look back, I don't remember having very clearly defined targets, very clearly defined KPIs and performance management.
Yeah.
And I think it's extremely important because if you can't list those two or three numbers that you want a person to move the needle for, how can you expect this person to succeed? Right.
Right. Or they'll just assume for themselves that they know what's best. And then you're very disconnected across lots of different teams versus all trying to move a couple things forward.
Correct. Yeah. Very great.
That's great.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, it sounds like you got a lot of great experience building EasyShip. And then one of the reasons I wanted to chat with you is about your questions and thoughts around label fraud in the industry, because I don't think it's very common to hear that out there. Everyone talks about payments fraud, because of Amazon and people shipping back boxes of sand or bricks. You hear about return fraud, but not necessarily label fraud. And so I guess I have so many questions to sort of start here, but like the simplest thing is like, what is label fraud and why did you even learn about it?
Sure. So label frauds is basically when there are professional fraudsters. So basically bad actors that intentionally come to a platform and they purchase labels with the purpose to resell those labels and make a profit. So the entire game makes sense when they can buy for pennies on the dollars and resell them for a higher price, right? So, I think if I just stop here, you will think of a reseller model where I buy from a platform and I sell to a consumer. But it's not like that. What I mean by the reason why they can make money is that they buy a label whose actual cost will be, let's say, $10, and they manage to buy for a lot less, and so they create an arbitrage. How do they do that? By, for example, under declaring weight, or saying that they're shipping from different parts of the country to skip zones, and in this kind of like incur into a lower cost, right? Mm-hmm. So basically pay for less. And then this platform or this fraudster resell these labels, either on other platforms online or in the dark web. And how did we answer your... So to answer your second part of the question, how did we learn about this? Unfortunately, we learned about this in the hard way.
The hard way. You got scammed.
Actually. And I think, pretty sure we're not the only one. It's kind of like, unfortunately, every platform has to deal with this is a risk business. Even though it's something that it has emerged a lot stronger in the past year or two compared to what it used to be. Like the EasyShip was started like 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And for the first, I would say, 8 years, we did not have frauds. Right. And then in the last 2 years, there's been a significant increase in attempts. And also talking to our partners and other platforms out there in general, we all talk to each other because we all in the same space.
Sure.
And everyone kind of like, when I mean, like, wow, did you guys encounter this issue? I'm like, yes, unfortunately so. And we're all kind of like also exchanging ideas on how to kind of like take all this. Right. But of course, I think in general, it's becoming a big problem.
Why did it emerge, you think, in the past 2 years? Either did people get smarter, or had logistics become so complicated that gamification got easier because there's just so many different nuances now?
Yes. It's difficult to pinpoint why now and not 10 years ago.
Yeah.
The idea is that we kind of like saw a bit of an evolution of, the type of frauds that we saw. And we kind of like look at it like we kind of like saw like four different type of frauds. And, and eventually, you know how fraudsters operate. Like they never stop. There's the void, right? So it may be like some flaws in security, and they just target that.
Yeah.
Until you secure that, you close that.
Yeah.
And once you close that, they look for the next one.
Right.
And it is a continuous fight between good and bad forces, right? Mm-hmm. So, you could see the first type of frauds was kind of like the zone skipping one. Mm-hmm. Where you kind of like had somebody buying, let's say, a label from New York to New Jersey. So they buy basically a zone one label, which is very cheap because it's very,
sure.
There's a very strong proximity. It's very close to each other. But in reality, they inject this parcel in California. So, of course, it would be a lot farther. It would be a lot more expensive as zone eight. So it's a lot more expensive, right? So, but then the courier may not have checked this. So once the parcel is in the network, it's already inside
the
network.
It's gone. Yeah.
So even if you purchase the label, like being injected from New Jersey, it's actually being injected from California. So this is what we saw. Then, of course, couriers became smart about that and they started to close that door. And then we saw kind of like the next iteration was about weight under declaration. So I buy a label for 1 pound of weight, and I actually ship a table, which the volumetric maybe is 30 pounds.
Right.
And then the courier come back, after a month with an invoice saying, actually, you ship 30 pounds, not 1 pound. So you need to give me the difference.
Right.
And the credit card has been stolen.
They're gone.
That's it. Finished. Catch me if you can. And then there is the third phase where it kind of like involved targeting, kind of like involving like big warehouses in the US, to which like tons of volume got injected from overseas, right? Mm-hmm. And I think for me it's a bit of a kind of like a groundbreaking type of frauds, because you kind of like can see the emergence of international players.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you look at this, you can kind of like think of, when you see kind of this, coming again to the example before, you're buying a table and you're buying it for whatever, $30 online, and you're wondering, how can that be? The shipping alone will be more expensive than that.
Yeah.
Right.
Probably because shipping was never paid in the first case. Mm. Right. Somebody used somebody else's credit card that were bought. They buy this list of stolen credit cards.
Yeah.
They try. One seems to work. Let me buy labels. Well, somebody else will be billed, so I got the label for free, right?
Yeah.
That's what happened. And then the fourth phase is kind of like also very similar to the first type of frauds, which was zone skipping. But by actually, what they do is that they actually Photoshop the shipping label. So they Photoshop the shipping label. They change the origin or the destination. They change the origin, and so they manage to zone skipped, because some couriers maybe don't see the difference between the things in the system and the date and what is written on the label.
And who's ultimately paying the price? Is it like the retailer, the businesses? Is it you guys? Is it the carriers? Is it a mix of all of those?
I think it's a mix of all, because so you kind of like see different consequences of that. For example, we can, like, if you look at, so sometimes taxpayers are the one that lose for this. For example, just if you, I think it happened in 2024, there's been a case where they found a person in California who alone made, defrosted the US PS by $150 million.
Oh, wow.
So in this case, USPS lost $150 million.
Yeah.
Who's going to pay for it? Eventually, it's going to be taxpayers, right?
Yeah.
So this is not great.
Wow.
And then other times when platforms get defrosted, like what do? They start increasing security. So they start introducing KYC, they start introducing the limitation of activities. And so this creates some frustration for the honest companies, the brands that just have to deal with a little bit more demanding user experience. So instead of signing up in seconds and generate labels, you get stopped, you need to ask, you need to insert your ID, you need to put some limitation as well.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, for me, the same thing is like, you know, when you cannot leave your bicycle outside unlocked, who pay for it? A bit everyone, you know, you need to buy a lock. You don't have peace of mind.
Yeah.
And that's a cost. That's the holistic cost of lack of security, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a fascinating thing. People don't talk about it. Definitely seller type fraud, I think, more than buyer fraud, has always been more insidious. I mean, we saw that at Barnes & Noble, where a seller signs up, and if you make it too easy for a seller to sign up, then the fraudsters will definitely find you. If you're not validating their bank address, you're not validating, or are they a real business? How do you know that they're real business? Marketplaces are way more sophisticated now that they need the like title, chain of custody of goods. They want to see your purchase orders. They want to know who your manufacturers are. They're not saying it because they want to steal your manufacturers, although sometimes maybe that happens. They're wanting to see it because they want to know that this is your real business.
It's legitimate. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And also eventually, also like, you know, the honest merchants have to pay higher shipping costs, because couriers eventually is a P&L, right? You know that they're going to every year. Whatever, I don't know, like I just come up with numbers, but 3% of your net revenue because of that. So what do? You need to increase rates.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Guess I'll go to the bingo card question. Is this a problem AI can solve, or is this some, like, are you guys experiencing?
More.
Yeah. Are you guys experiencing or experimenting with it, or like, where have you kind of found the pockets of maybe some systemic solutions here?
Yeah, definitely. I think there are variety of ways that the variety of angles that couriers can use to fight this. I think it's a fight that can't be played by the couriers alone. I think it involves multiple players. There is the carriers, there is the platforms, there are the sales channel, there are the regulators. Everyone has their roles. AI is one of the angle. I don't think alone is enough, but you know, it can be used to, machine learning especially, it could be great, and that analytics identify and intercept and retain packages with counterfeit or hijacked labels, and then potentially rerouting them to specialized facilities that can be used to park these fraudulent packages. While the courier find a way to identify these bad actors, right?
Yeah.
And did you find in these fraud, the types of parcels that were being shipped, were they just sort of anything, or were they actually sort of illicit merchandise? Is that kind of primarily the angle too?
It's a bit of everything. Like we got some packages that we actually realized that they were frauds, and we alerted the carriers, and then the carriers, when they stopped, they opened and there was like narcotics inside or other things. But this actually is not the majority. Majority is actually legit products. And actually, if you want to hear a fun story, like January of this year, my colleagues still make fun of me here because I was at CES in Vegas and I woke up one morning and there has been a fraud. And so they told me, you know, there are 40 plus addresses who are in Vegas. Tom, you're there. Can you take a Uber, go door to door and check what is there? You know, like, let's understand what's there. And so I went door to door with Uber.
Seriously?
Yeah, I did that with one of my colleagues, which was a lot bigger than me, because, you know, just want to have some.
That's what I'm wondering. I'm like, that's pretty brave of you. And like, do you get your own like personal security? Like, what's happening?
So I actually just ask. I say, sorry to bother you, but I know it's not your fault. But you receive a parcel which may come from illegal activities. I would like to ask some questions if possible. And of course, a significant part of people didn't even open the door, but some people were actually very nice and very collaborative. And so they kind of like showed me what they had. And actually, most of them, they were actually like middlemen where they bought from other countries like a bulk of, let's say, 50 water bottles, yeah. And they were selling them on Facebook like as a side gig. And so sure. They were like, I just bought them. I was going to resell them. Is there any problem? I say, well, you didn't do anything wrong, but the company that sold it to you actually used a label who was fraudulently purchased, right? But this also allows us to understand kind of like a bit more the nature behind it. And after that, we kind of like change a lot of our systems to kind of like be able to spot this.
Interesting. Wow.
That's crazy. That door-to-door fraud checker. That could be your next career.
You're like your own investigative reporter.
It's like what the CEO of NVIDIA was saying, right? There is nothing beneath me. It's
Tommaso finds out. Yeah. That's the next series.
You have your own little show. Yeah. You're like, I will hunt you down. I will find you.
Do what you got to do.
Yeah.
I mean,
exactly.
Given the scope and the scale of the problem, do you feel like this should be more visible in the industry from, you know, even like, you know, I'm not necessarily, obviously, you say what you could say, but payment fraud, everyone hears about. Like, this feels like an ongoing narrative in the industry that it needs to combat and shine some more light on if we're going to eventually resolve it.
Yes, I think that, so I think it's still quite recent, like it's been in the last couple of years only that we see a massive increase of this. I think that we should talk a lot more about it, not necessarily publicly through papers and so on, because you also want to limit the emulation principle. You don't want to kind of like shout out to every other officer. Hey guys, this thing is happening. You
this is easy to do.
This is the new hot thing.
But I think we should have a lot more kind of like behind closed doors conversation between couriers, between regulators, between platforms, as I mentioned before, because there are a lot of things that can be done to limit this. And don't get me wrong, I think frauds will always be there because it's the cost of doing business, but it can be limited, right?
Right. And do you think this is on the government's radar?
I don't think so particularly.
Yeah.
Like, again, I'm not sure. I don't sit in with them to maybe it is, but if it is, they don't show it, I think.
Yeah.
I think also for us working with authorities, I understand that there are much bigger problems that requires their attention. I'm not qualified to judge on the resources they have and other priorities they have, but I can just say that as a customer, let's say, there has not been the attention that should be given to this phenomenon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's interesting.
You talk about, who ultimately pays. Sounds like you guys have had to rework tons of things, invest in this, and you know, that takes you away from continuing to innovate as well. I think you've said before, like it's a very heavily regulated, compliance-oriented industry. How do you feel like, you know, that compares to others? Like, do you guys feel like there's more regulations in logistics and supply chain and compliance management that you have to deal with, and maybe even other parts of the business and parts of the whole like customer experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think that compared to other industries is not as regulated. Mm-hmm. I think it's changing. I think there are a lot of changes out there, which kind of makes sense for most part. I think that, for example, for us, we had to kind of like implement like a clear KYC, like a more advanced KYC mm-hmm. process compared to before. So we have to kind of like making it a lot more strict. That eventually, as Rick mentioned before, it hurts your customer experience because it is less immediate to interact with the platform. But I think eventually it's what everyone is doing, and I think you will see more and more of this, right?
Yeah.
No, it's fascinating. I mean, I want to pivot the discussion a little bit away from fraud because that's not, I think, the only interesting thing, but also kind of cross-border e-com, particularly in the United States. It just always feels like it's underinvested. I mean, there's always, it seems like, something more that a merchant can do to improve the conversion of their website or increase the speed to the domestic customers or improve their AOV. And then international is just like other thing that's always like 12 months away. What's wrong about this attitude in here, even as we sit in 2025?
Yes, I think that, you know, the US is a massive market, of course. So most brands prefer to, you know, move from 90% optimized to 90% optimized in the US alone, because you better to optimize one market instead of optimizing 50 more that will account in the same market of the US. But at the same time, I think, once you reach a point where you think you've already optimized most of it, as you mentioned, I think that there is not much attention, or at least not as much attention as it should be, to international. US is a massive market, but it's not the only market. Europe is a very rich consumer-based market. Asia as well, Australia, China. So the idea is there is a lot of opportunities out there. Also, the cost of marketing is a lot lower in these markets, right? If you pay per click there, it's a lot less. So I think that historically, also the barriers of entry were very high because you had to localize everything, translate everything, and so on. Now also with AI, all of that is gone because you can translate your product description in seconds in 200 languages and it's spotless. Collect payments from any part, any country in the world with very efficient FX rates coming from like this, some of the major fintech companies. Tax and duty has always been a concern. And I think now also consumers in the US kind of like start having to deal with that, right? Historically, it wasn't the case. But there are a lot of ways to automate that. And we see that brands that start looking overseas and start targeting 5-6 markets, they can increase their revenues by 20-30% just by that, right? And again, it's not easy, don't get me wrong, but it is a very solid lever. And I think that historically, US market was growing very much, especially, you know, with COVID, there's been a lot of more disposable income. As consumers couldn't travel that much anymore, so they kind of like bought a lot more online, and there's been an explosion of e-commerce volume. This is now kind of like slowing down significantly in the past couple of years, and especially if you look at the, for example, some couriers' stocks, they are significantly down because the volume is not as much as before, right? So I think in general now is a time more than ever to start looking at other levers for growth, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So de minimis in all of the changes, it felt like it was a roller coaster for a bit there. How's this reform changing cross-border and a company's ability to do that effectively, as well as just kind of manage, navigate through all the other reform and change that kind of continually happens in logistics.
Yeah, that's a great point. So I think that the main changes has been just in getting goods to the US from overseas. Mm-hmm. But this is the main implication. So if you are an American brand that needs to import your stock because it's manufactured overseas, of course, this is going to cost you more. But then once you have to sell it overseas, there's been absolutely no changes because no countries has updated their custom processes or taxes for goods coming from the US.
Yep.
Right? So those brands that were shipping from the US to overseas before are not going to see any changes until now. We'll see later, of course. But that is as simple as before, in a way.
So for the U.S. selling cross-border, it's not really something to worry about. For importing, clearly, you know, I was speaking with a lot of CEOs last week at the Beanstalk event, for instance, and most of them were saying to me that you were not really going to see the impact of the end of de minimis and tariffs kind of combined until, like, now. Because there are a lot of inventory people bought 3-4 months ago, you know, before the tariffs and these things were in place, and they were asking suppliers to make adjustments, and they were finding other cost savings. But at some point, those things run out, and then there's an effect on demand of pricing. If prices go up, demand goes down.
I'm personally quite concerned with the level of consumption in the US. I think it's gonna go down, and I hope to be wrong. But at least in the short term, prices are gonna go up significantly, and it's a simple microeconomy.
Yeah. Theory, right? Yeah. Exactly. And cross border, I mean, it kind of feels like there's a few different categories of cross border. Having spent some time at Pitney Bowes in the past, there's like, especially for US brands, it's English is spoken everywhere. There's a lot of expats. There's almost like cross-border and then a place where you need the more global commerce, where you need inventory in country. But for cross-border, there's almost like the two types, like the complex kind where you need to like localize every single thing. But there's almost call it like expat cross-border, meaning like you're dealing with somebody who used to live in the US or who's very comfortable buying from a US brand because they know what to expect. They may not know what to expect to get to wait a week or to pay a duty or whatever, but at least they know how to shop from US brands easily.
Totally agree. I think in general, like I think that the first lever to increase your exponential your international revenues is just to allow international buyers to purchase from your store. Even for me now, sometimes when I talk to prospect clients, when I have to buy things from their website, I'm like, I see that if I'm based in France, you don't sell there. Why not? Yeah, I'm a visitor coming to your website. I'm telling you, I won't take my money. You don't want to take it. It's like, imagine if you have an offline store and somebody walk into your store and say, I'm from France. Can I buy? Sorry, we don't sell to French clients. Why? This is the easiest one, like enable your store to receive orders from anywhere, even if the shipping costs, even if you say, okay, but the shipping cost is not as efficient as if I had a domestic warehouse in France. Sure, I agree with you, but it's still better to not give the option at all, right?
Right.
And then I think there is a second level of optimization that is if you start to get early data that, you know, this market is performing quite well, despite the fact that you're not optimized for the market, then double down even more. You know, start to find local distributors, start to work with local marketplaces, start to put your stock in local warehouses. So then you can double down. But like, I think it's very important to go from 0 to 1 for allowing everyone to buy from your store, and then from 1 to 10 by optimizing even more, right? But sometimes I see off brands that kind of like, oh, but I cannot be perfect, so I'm not going to do it.
Right, yeah. Right.
Which is not, I think, the best approach in business, right? It's important to start with an MVP and test assumptions, right?
Yeah.
So help me write this cross-border playbook. It kind of feels like we have the ends. Like on one end, it's like you can't buy, now you can buy. So at least you can buy. Mm-hmm. You might be paying FX fees and everything. and you might be surprised by duties at the door. But then the other side is that, like, having inventory in country, you can get it the same day or within 2 days or something like this. In terms of, like, before you're doubling down, like, okay, now everyone could buy and any country could buy. Now you maybe have a list of 10 countries that are buying from your website that you didn't before. What are the signals, particularly, that you should be looking for to help prioritize which markets to invest in? And is it primarily about reducing friction at this stage, or is it more about adding marketing to those?
Very good question. So what I would do is I will start by looking at the traffic on my website to see, like, where are visitors coming from? And this gives you already an idea.
Just like visitors by country.
Yes. Yes. On GA or any other, on Shopify or any other websites and platforms, they give you this kind of analytics. So you can kind of, like, see already if there is any organic traffic, because maybe there's been some trending Instagram KOL or influencer that tried your product, was very excited about it, and they start getting traction in this country. And then based on that, I will start to kind of, like, I will kind of, like, divide the world in areas, right? So I will look at Europe, APAC, North, like Middle East, Africa, Latin America. And then I will kind of, like, go in region. For example, say, let's say that I want to, I see some interesting demand from France, Germany, Italy, and the UK. Probably the first thing to do is to start distributing, finding one warehouse partner for Europe. It will not be optimized, but at least you have some regional presence, right? Then I will start doing, for the one that works very well, I will start to do, like, localized ads, right? Now also with AI, you can localize super efficiently, running multiple variations of messaging in different languages instantly. You can kind of, like, also doing customer support, like translating in different languages, right? So even when customer write to you, you can easily interact with them. And then going more granular by basically, okay, now I have enough volume from this specific country. Let me store items there to leverage from even cheaper shipping costs. But, you know, it's very important not to overstretch, because you may have some savings in last mile shipping, but you're incurring a lot higher overhead in terms of complexity. You know, if you need to manage 10 different warehouse partners, it's a lot of work, right? You need to have the scale for that.
So I think the place to as we kind of wrap up, do you think logistics has, like, a PR problem or a branding problem? And why I ask is, I think, you know, a lot of times brands focus on the creative, the go-to-market. It's kind of what's visible. Logistics is always viewed as a cost center, not necessarily a growth engine per se. But when it falls apart, like, it everything breaks loose, right? Like, it's the worst experience for the customer. You end up probably doing more damage control and having to spend a lot more versus you just kind of got it right from a foundational perspective. So how do we make logistics hot?
For me, it is sexy. So I think that in general, like, eventually an industry becomes sexy when it creates big companies who makes a lot of money and splash it, right? Which is not really happening in logistics just yet, right? Like, the biggest players are still the traditional players, like Maersk, MSCs, these guys. But there has not been a $50 billion company in the e-commerce tech logistics space, right? While you have those in fintech, for example, right?
Yeah.
There are several. So I think that has to happen. When we're going to have the first three or four big companies there, the industry will become sexy because there will be even more money in the space. And it doesn't mean that in logistics there is none, because the industry is less promising than fintech. Actually, I think when you look at how big the market is for logistics versus fintech, logistics is like 10 times bigger than fintech.
Yeah.
It touches everything we buy, everything we do, right?
Kind of spend, so, yeah.
the market, the size is already there. But I think that the reason why there has not been any massive player yet is because logistics is a lot less scalable than fintech. Like in fintech, you can open up, you can start a product and go live basically and go live worldwide. In logistics, you can't cut corner. But yeah, is you work with a carrier in the US. You if you want to offer those shipping functionality in Germany, you need to start from zero again.
Right.
You need to open an entity there. You need to you sign a contract there. So basically, the barriers to entry are very, very high. It's a lot more tedious and requires a lot more operational work. Yeah. So it just takes a lot. It does take a longer time to scale, but at the same time, it's a lot more defendable because somebody else want to kind of like come into the market with the same thing.
Yeah, it's complicated.
They can raise 20x more money than you. They can hire better developers than you. But certain things just
they're all behind. Yeah,
you need to go to every single courier in every single country and start from zero again. And this thing you can't cut corners. So it's just kind of like a elasticity in there, right? It's less scalable but more defendable in my way. So there will be juggernauts in the space. It will just take a little bit more time. And I think once that happens, the industry will get its rightful place in history.
That's right.
This has been really great, Tommaso. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your insights about cross-border, the problem of shipping label fraud, as well as how does a finance guy turn into a logistics nerd. And so it was fun to hear your story on the show. I know Jess and I had a lot of fun doing this.
Yeah, congrats on everything you built. It's amazing. I mean, going entrepreneurship is so hard. So I'm sure there's like a lot of the story you've not been able to tell, and we'll have to have you on again. But thank you so much. It was really a pleasure to talk to you, and I've learned a ton.
Yes, thanks, Jess and Rick. It was great to be here. Thanks a lot for your time. I had a great time.
Great.
Awesome. We'll thanks so much.
Bye.
That's going to do it for this week's Watson Weekend. If you've made it this far, you're either a retail masochist or you just love the sound of our voices.
I'm going to say it's option two. Either way, we appreciate you. If you've enjoyed today's show, give us a follow, give us a like wherever you're listening. Leave us a review, preferably with 5 stars. We'll take 4.5 if you're feeling a little bit stingy. Yeah, it's okay.
And don't just lurk on the channel. Share this with a friend, colleague.
That's right. We're kind of like your little sidekick, helping you bring everybody along in your organization. You can find us on LinkedIn, your Spotify, all the places. And all the links are in the show notes, too.
Big thanks to the community, our listeners, as well as the Kaplan Snacks that keep this circus running. Sponsors, you know who you are. And if you're not a sponsor yet,
I mean, what are you actually doing with your marketing budget? Give us a ring. Call us. Send an email. Rick loves when people slide into his DM. It's his favorite place.
Until next time, I'm Rick Watson.
And I'm Jessica Lisewski. Thanks for spending part of your day with us. Now, you can feel like you can go on and do something better with your life. We'll see you next week.
Bye.